Actually, no, this has been a true collaboration. And of course, I want to acknowledge my collaborators, Roya, of course, and Aviva Shakel, a grad student at UCLA, at Mehran in the front row, and then Lincoln Chase, a very creative mathematical physicist or applied mathematician at UCLA. And I'll start where all discussions of the critical Casimir force now start, and that's with the experiment by Garcia and Chan, in which they had a set of basically of capacitor plates that were arranged above a bath of liquid helium. And what they did is they cooled the helium through the lambda point and looked at the thickness of the film. So just get this started as a laser, as a pointer. I don't know how well. Yeah, it's pretty. Is there a pointer that I can? This is actually a very weak one. Oh, great. I assume that's it. Yeah. So they looked at the thickness of the vapor, and that the vapor thickness is a direct measure. It registers directly the force that well, not only that the plate exerts, the van der Waals force, and of course the gravitational potential as you take this higher and higher, the film gets thinner and thinner, but also any forces that are generated internally in the film, and in particular, the forces that arise due to critical fluctuations as the film is cooled through the lambda point. And what they see is, let me see, did I do this? Oops. Well, this is a bit strange. Okay. It seems that animation or something don't show up. Anyway, there's the height of the film, and then there's the width of it, which somehow disappeared from this figure. And by monitoring this as they cooled through, what they would see is as the temperature is cooled below the lambda temperature, the film gets precipitously or fairly precipitously thinner. This is actually not that precipitously because notice this is an angstrom. So it's a few monolayers thinner. If this is plotted in a scaling form, that is, versus not the difference between the temperature and the lambda temperature, but in terms of that temperature difference multiplied by the nominal film thickness, because this there's not much of a change in it, raised to the 1/nu, that's a standard scaling variable, these curves in principle should collapse. What they found in their first experiment is that there was a discrepancy, as you can see. What they discovered in a subsequent experiment, which I guess will show up here, is in fact that when they controlled the substrate a bit better, these curves all did collapse. And in fact, this is the scaling combination, and this is presumably a scaling function, which I'll talk about a little more, to which they should all collapse. So let me just go back and talk about the three regimes that are encompassed by the experiment. There's first what I call the normal phase regime, that is for a temperature that goes down to the critical temperature. There is a critical, what I'll call a critical regime, which is immediately below that temperature, and that includes this substantial dip in the film thickness. And then there's what I would call the superfluid phase. So this is kind of well below this, but in principle, the film now has fully developed superfluid properties. The normal phase behavior actually has been well explained, and the explanation has been known for a while. Michael Kreft actually did the calculations, and what he showed is that if you do one loop and two loop calculations of the force that gives rise to this change in the film thickness, he got a result that was very close to what was measured. One thing that you notice here, though, is that the film thickness doesn't recover, and what that means is that there is an additional Casimir force mediated by fluctuations within the film, and Roya and I and Mehran came up with what we believe is an explanation for that, and that is in terms of fluctuations that occurred not only within the bulk of the film, but along the surface of the film. And that left the one remaining region, the regime to be explained. And that, of course, is the central one. And here, the explanation we believe now exists. It was done more or less effectively independently by three different groups. Masiolek et al. Actually explained it, described it in terms of a kind of a much more general investigation of critical Casimir force that not only discussed the critical point, but also the tri-critical point. You know, they constructed fairly comprehensive phase diagrams. Hooked actually did a Monte Carlo calculation, and the results of his calculation coincide quite well with the data. And then Roya and Mehran and Lincoln and Aviva and I actually produced a much briefer, but a simpler explanation, but one again that I think explains what goes on here. And so actually, let me just go back to this. You know, the question that actually, the reason that this was a bit of a puzzle is that results had been known, sorry about that, I've got to go through the whole animation to get to the next slide, is that work had been done, both Monte Carlo and analytic, on the Casimir force that is due, the Casimir force that is due to these critical fluctuations of various kinds of systems, including Ising-like XY, which presumably is the one that describes the liquid helium, and in fact for N equals 3, which would be Heisenberg-like, and N equals infinity, which is described analytically by the spherical model. And what you see is if you look again at this kind of reduced temperature, this variable, which is now, they use N as a measure of the thickness of the film, you can actually see that the Casimir force has its greatest amplitude. You know, this would correspond to a thinning of the film right at the critical point, with nothing spectacular happening below, just a recovery, either a full or a partial recovery, meaning a kind of a disappearance of the Casimir force, or at least a reduction of the Casimir force below. This, however, was done for systems with periodic boundary conditions. These were for systems with periodic boundary conditions, and there's another attempt to explain the Casimir force by Gary Williams using quantized vortices. In any case, given those previous results, the question was what was the cause of that substantial Casimir force kind of below the critical point? And the reason, at least appears to be, the reason I think we now pretty much know to be, that the appropriate boundary conditions to apply to a superfluid, you know, that's confined to a system is Dirichlet. That is, the order parameter, the superfluid order parameter, is basically required to disappear at the boundaries of the system. And it is a fairly remarkable result that just changing the boundary conditions gives you such a substantial change, alteration in the size of the Casimir force. But in fact, that is, at least we found out by simple calculations and validated by Monte Carlo, that that is indeed the case. So anyway, this slide is, of course, the question of what is so special about Dirichlet boundary conditions. And in fact, there are two features of Dirichlet boundary condition that contribute to the behavior of the Casimir force. The first, and this goes back to the original, to a paper, you know, the classic paper of Ginsburg and Landau, is that Dirichlet boundary conditions tend to suppress ordering. Basically, by forcing the order parameter to be zero on a surface, it means that you actually have to lower the temperature of the system to some distance, to some amount below the critical temperature, the kind of the bulk critical temperature for ordering to occur. And in the case, the classical case, in the mean field case, investigated by Ginsburg and Landau, the difference goes like pi over L squared, where L is the thickness of the film. There's another thing that occurs, that feature that Dirichlet boundary conditions have, and that is because you have an effective alteration in the reduced temperature that goes with the film thickness. That means that if you change the film thickness for a fixed temperature, that's like changing the temperature for a fixed film thickness, at least in the vicinity of the critical point. So let me just tell you the punchline there. That means that if you take a derivative of the film free energy, that is actually what gives rise to the Casimir force. If you take the derivative of that with respect to film thickness, it's like taking the derivative with respect to temperature when you're near the critical point, which means that you're going to get entropic-like behavior. If there is an interesting feature in the entropy of a system, it will show up in the Casimir force. Okay, so this is a very brief description of how Roy Azandi et al. Came up with a description, an explanation for the Casimir force. And what this is this is just a plot of the derivative of the free energy of a film with respect to the film thickness. That derivative is zero until you get to minus pi over L squared. And this graph is going to be basically because D is, unfortunately, we change a variable. D is L here. It's pi squared is about 10. So until you get down to here close to minus 10, there is no derivative because there is no ordering in the film in the mean field theory. And in mean field theory, if there's no ordering, there's no interesting thermodynamic behavior. Then what you see is it departs from that, and notice that there's a discontinuity in the slope. That's the entropy feature. The entropy in mean field theory in standard mean field theory of a second order phase transition has a discontinuity in its slope, right? And so you see that, and then it dips down. And so this is what you get when you take the free energy. Now that's, in order to get the Casimir force, that's not the prime, that's a part of that's part of the calculation. The thing that you have to notice is that the film is in equilibrium with a reservoir of fluid. And so that any change in the amount of matter in the film is basically compensated for. There's a compensation from a change in the amount of matter in the reservoir. And the net change in the free energy of the system, which is what really gives you the force, is going to be the difference between, the free energy increase here and the free energy increase here, right? Or it's the free energy increase here minus the free energy decrease there. And if you take that into account, that means that the real force is due to the difference between the two. And so what I graph here for this green line is this is the derivative of the free energy of the reservoir with respect to basically its width. Now, if you have a very thick system and you increase it, you basically increase the thickness of it by adding matter on the surface, that's basically the same as kind of pulling this surface up, leaving a little bit of, leaving a little gap in the center and then filling it with the molecules. And so that measures the amount of free energy that's in the interior. Because what happens at the surface just gets translated up. You're not changing any, you're not really changing the surface energy. So the proper thing to subtract here is basically a bulk free energy. And once you have done that, once you've made that subtraction, you get this curve. And in mean field theory, because nothing happens above the critical temperature, it's basically zero here. And then you get this dip, and the slope discontinuity here is again a reflection of the kind of the singular behavior in the entropy of a mean field system. All right, well, that was what we posited. You can actually do some other calculations to show that the ratio of the amplitude of the Casimir force here to the amplitude of the Casimir force there, according to some very simple field theoretical calculations, should be substantial. And actually, in our calculation, what we got is a difference by a factor of almost 70, when the difference is actually a factor of something like 20 to 30. But this is a very primitive argument. It's not an exact one. Actually, well, there's a bit of animation. So given that, we actually then got interested in a different set of questions. And that is, so now that you know that Dirichlet boundary conditions can have a substantial impact on the Casimir force of a system, we asked if we could just look at other systems, in principle systems in which we could get exact solutions could be extracted, to see what influence does the combination of boundary conditions and dimensionality exert on the critical Casimir force. And yeah.
Do it in mean field theory, does the film recover to the same thickness below the transition?
If, yeah, if you do the Yiskin model and mean field theory, the Casimir force disappears at sufficiently low temperatures.
So there's complete recovery.
There's complete recovery. There is complete recovery in the Ising system. And it actually is because the lack of complete recovery in other systems is because of Goldstone modes that continue to contribute these kind of long-range fluctuations. But the Ising system is, of course, a broken discrete symmetry. So now we've departed from the XY model. Of course, the mean field theory, at least the mean field level, doesn't distinguish. So, but if we kind of gone, if we gone to one loop order, we would have found extra. So if you look at the Ising model, we actually we considered three cases, one of which is amenable to fairly simple analysis. The second of which, this is the first one-dimensional Ising model with a zero-dimensional film. That's a one-dimensional bulk in equilibrium with a zero-dimensional film. The two-dimensional Ising model, there the results can be abstracted with a reasonable amount of effort. And then the four-dimensional version of the Ising model, the O1 model, here the film is three-dimensional, and so there are certain challenges I want to talk about. And as far as the third piece of investigation goes, this is a progress report. This is not where I'm going to give you results that, you know, I think will stand the test of time. Anyway, the one-dimensional Ising model, it's an interesting exercise. You know, the film is just a fixed, a strip of, you know, a collection of spins on kind of aligned in a linear array, a fixed number, and the bulk is an infinite set of them. The general form for the critical Casimir force, which actually follows from finite size scaling theory, I assume that if you were at Moses Chan's talk, you would certainly have known about this, and so I'm not going to talk about the derivation. It basically goes, the Casimir force goes like 1 over the film thickness raised to the power of the dimensionality of the bulk system times a universal scaling function of reduced temperature, temperature minus critical temperature, times the thickness raised to 1 over nu, where nu is the correlation length exponent. In the case of a one-dimensional system, this formula reduces to that because d is 1. However, in a one-dimensional Ising model, the phase transition is at t equals 0, and this is an inconvenient set of collection of parameters to use. And so instead of this, you can write it as the film thickness over the correlation length. In fact, if you take this to the nth power, that it would be, and just use the fact that the correlation length goes like tau to the minus nu, you would get something like this. And so I just want to focus on this particular formula. I think everybody in this room has done the 1D Ising model. I mean, you certainly did it in graduate school, if not as an undergraduate. It's, you know, there's a transfer matrix. It's a 2x2 transfer matrix. It has 2 eigenvectors. This is no magnetic field. It has 2 eigenvectors. It's got one that's even and one that's basically, I'll call it even and an odd eigenvector. Each has a eigenvalue, which is very simple to calculate. Just multiply this by this and then divide the vector out. And then that means you can write the transfer matrix as a kind of a two-term eigenfunction expansion. And then in the case of periodic boundary conditions, the partition function is very simple. You just raise this to the number of spins, and L, I'm just using L as just to keep that notation. So if you have L spins in a row, that just becomes this to the L plus that to the L, standard for raising the taking the trace of an operator. The free energy is going to look like that, and I'm basically going to end up dropping this to keep things nice. And then you can pull out the bulk, the free energy of the bulk system. That's just the part that goes like log of lambda, the even lambda to the L. You can define a correlation length where that correlation length is given by this ratio. And in that case, this free energy of the system becomes the bulk free energy times the thickness of the system minus this term. And then, again, if you take the derivative, subtract the bulk free energy to get the, actually, this is the negative of the Casimir force, unfortunately. If you get something that looks like this, if I basically divide by L because I want to take out the factor of 1 over L, I get this. And in fact, then G, this quantity script G, is the scaling function I talked about earlier. And it looks like that. Okay, so that's a fairly simple calculation of a kind of a universal critical function for the Casimir force on a one-dimensional icing, basically one-dimensional icing model with periodic boundary conditions. For free boundary conditions, and that's what you would basically, those are the kind of conditions you can apply to a spin-up, spin-down model. You can also think of that as a version of Dirichlet boundary condition where you put a dead layer of spins, spins that are arbitrarily set equal to zero at each boundary, in which case the spins immediately next to them don't see anything and therefore act as if they have no interaction with the outside world. Those are free boundary conditions. Then what you do is you basically sum over the two components, of the transfer matrix raised to the Lth power, and that's like sandwiching it between the even eigenvector, and that just gives you the transfer matrix multiplied by 2. So the partition function looks like that. But of course, all that is the dominant part of the transfer matrix to the Lth power for an infinite system. So if you take the log of it to get the free energy, you're just going to get this raised to the Lth power. If you take the derivative with respect to L, it is the bulk free energy. So in the case of free boundary condition, there is absolutely no Casimir force, and certainly no critical Casimir force. I should just keep going. We also looked at the continuous version of the one-dimensional Ising model, the O1 model. And in that case, again, if you have an effective Hamiltonian and a partition function, and it's all in one dimension using Feynman-Hibbs, the connection between path integrals and the Schrödinger equation, you can define the transfer matrix in terms of eigenfunctions that satisfy an eigenvalue equation, and the associated eigenvalues for the transfer matrix are going to look like that. And in fact, this is the width. This is just the width of the region over which T operates, and the transfer matrix just looks like this. It's a very standard set of calculations. And in the case of periodic boundary conditions, this is what you get for the partition function. In the case of Dirichlet boundary conditions, you're forcing the argument of this to be equal to zero, so it looks like that with a sum. And in the case of free boundary conditions, you're just integrating over all possible values of the argument of these transfer matrices. So it looks like that. The thing to notice is that when you look at the Schrödinger-like equation, the eigenvalues, when the reduced temperature becomes very small and negative, I just should say that this is, the reduced temperature is now this variable here. When the reduced temperature gets very large and negative, the eigenvalues start pairing off, and that's because the effective potential in the Schrödinger equation becomes two very deep and well-separated parabolic wells. And you just get the even and odd combinations of the lowest eigenstates in those wells. And that's important because it's going to be turn out that it's the difference between the two leading eigenvalues that gives you the correlation length in the system. Just again, these are graphs of these eigenfunctions associated with the lowest eigenvalues. There's an even one and there's an odd one. As you might expect, the critical point here is at r equals minus infinity. There actually is no critical point, but that's where it approaches criticality in one dimension. The correlation length goes like 1 over the difference between the two largest eigenvalues. I actually have these shifted. It should be 1 over lambda 1 minus lambda 2. For periodic boundary conditions, just doing a sum over e to the minus lambda 1l plus e to the minus lambda 2l plus all that. For Dirichlet boundary conditions, you're doing the same sum but multiplied by the square of these eigenfunctions at zero argument. And because this one is odd, it's going to fall out of the sum, which means the leading order one is here, and then there's going to be the third term here. In free boundary conditions, you have these integrals. But again, because this function is odd, it integrates to zero. What that means is that when you kind of then fold things into a free energy and pull out the correlation length dependence, the only one that's going to give you the proper correlation length dependence is this term, because it retains the second leading eigenvalue that merges with the first eigenvalue as the temperature of the system, its reduced temperature, gets very, very low. And again, you just end up with the same critical result. So So the kind of the end result of this very simple set of exercises is that in one dimension, at least for the easing model, periodic boundary conditions gives you a critical Casimir force, and the other, and the free or Dirichlet boundary conditions do not. In fact, they don't give you any. They don't give you anything, any critical Casimir force.
Let me ask you, so if the system size is much smaller than the correlation length, then you should get power law or some slowly decaying interaction. Is that the case?
If the size of the
system is smaller than the correlation length.
All right, so you're thinking of the film. Actually, if you look back, you can actually see how it's going to behave, yeah. What that would mean is that this argument, all of these arguments are going to zero, right? So this basically goes to one, that goes to one, that goes to zero, so right, it would decay as a power law now. That's right. Actually, interestingly, just from a discussion with Meron this morning, he asked what would happen with anti-periodic boundary conditions. And it looks like, at least according to a sketched out calculation on a blackboard, that it doesn't disappear at L over C goes to zero for reasons that, I don't know, may have to do with an interface that's wandering around and forcing the Casimir force. Creating a Casimir force. So let me talk about two-dimensional easing model. Here, it's not something you can do on a finite set of PowerPoint slides, the calculation. But on the other hand, the results from which it can be derived can be each put on a PowerPoint slide. The first, we start with the case of free boundary conditions. And here, we took results of Lee, Pachuski, Kardar, and Huang, and I basically just cut and pasted the relevant expressions. And so it takes a bit of work to reduce these expressions, but what you discover is that you actually can extract a critical Casimir force from that, and that's what it looks like. For free boundary conditions, the critical Casimir force is basically this integral. The omega is an integration variable, and little t is this scaling combination. And so actually, it's not quite there. This 1 over n squared should have been excised. This is the thickness of the film raised to the nth power. So you got to get rid of that part. But then when you're all done, you end up with a curve that looks like this. So it actually has some of the features of what was seen in superfluid helium films, and that is it is substantially lower immediately below the critical temperature than it is at the critical temperature. The ratio is not nearly as large as what they found. You know, it's a factor of something like 7 or 8 larger.
There's relation between this force, the free boundary condition, and it's related to plus boundary condition. There is a like a relation that this force is minus force for the plus boundary condition with the reflective argument.
Oh, okay.
And it follows just from this calculation. You can have a look at Spetsky and Evans' paper about solvation force. Then it was a different name for this kind of forces.
I see. So if you actually...
And they had derived for plus and plus minus boundary condition, and they spotted this relation between the free boundary condition and plus boundary condition, and it's there in this paper.
Okay, thank you. I mean, I think what I would, my general argument would be that Dirichlet boundary, that free boundary conditions, which are like Dirichlet boundary conditions, tend to suppress ordering. And so what happens is, if you're in equilibrium with a bulk, then as the bulk condenses, its free energy goes down just because of the condensation, and would tend to kind of pull. It would tend to pull, see if I get that right. Because a repulsive force actually tends to, no, this is an attractive force. This is an attractive force, so it tends to thin the film. So as the bulk condenses, it actually tends to pull material off the film. And then when you get to low enough temperature, the film itself condenses, and ultimately its, you know, kind of its free energy becomes competitive with the bulk. Because as it gets, the temperature gets lower and lower, the correlation length gets small enough. So that again, the, you know, again, increasing the thickness of the film is like pulling the surface part, you know, away from, you know, kind of the, pulling the two surface parts away and exposing a part piece of the interior that the molecules can go into. Well, actually, there seems to have been an argument between us and other people. I think that to understand it thermodynamically, you have to know that this is a film, because when you do this, you actually, if you do the full calculation for the derivative, you get a part that is just basically the derivative of the free energy of the whole free energy of a bulk system with respect to its equivalent. I mean, for instance, let me get be a little bit stumbling.
A question: why doesn't it start off above the critical temperature already?
Oh, I think because of the fluctuations. I mean, the fluctuations arise above the critical temperature. In a mean field theory it wouldn't. In a pure mean field theory it wouldn't. But this is actually the exact solution of the two-dimensional Ising model. So it's, yeah. Yes, right. And so in fact it does recover as the correlation length, as basically the correlation length recovers. Right. It becomes smaller.
And does this shift change if you use, you know, fixed animations or something?
Well, apparently.
So plus plus, you will have just.
Which I find, which I.
Plus minus, you go to the pulsing force with a maximum below TC.
I'm a bit surprised. No, there is a case in which it is symmetric around TC, and that's the periodic boundary conditions. And there the. They're the relevant formulas. Actually, this is from Ferdinand and Fisher, but they credit Brury and Kaplan with this formula. And again, it's several sets of steps, but it actually reduces to quite a simple formula here. And there is a feature that we found very puzzling. This is analytic here. This isn't a slope discontinuity. If you look at it closely enough, it is parabolic there. But there is this puzzling structure that follows from this extremely simple formula.
Yeah, actually, you can explain that in terms of a 1D
Ising. You can?
Years and years ago. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
I would like. Okay, thank you. And it is pure, and it is completely symmetric. And I think, as Mehran pointed out, it's undoubtedly symmetric because of the periodic Ising model is a pure self-dual model. So anyway, if you plot them both together, just to see what's the effect of boundary conditions, you can see that free boundary conditions tend to kind of push the maximum of the Casimir force below the critical temperature. But on the other hand, the amplitudes of the forces are very close to each other. So as opposed to basically the three-dimensional helium film, in which the Dirichlet boundary conditions induce a force that is much larger than you would expect from periodic boundary conditions, or in the 1D Ising model, in which the only case you only get a critical force for periodic boundary conditions. Here they're about the same.
There are,
yeah, in fact, there are, yeah, the, yes, conformal field theory actually gives exact results for this and that. And one of the, when we were puzzled by our result, and these were checked by three of us, we actually, one of the checks we made was that these were exactly what conformal field theory predicts, and they are. So let me talk about the third part, and this is work in progress. And this is the question of what about a four-dimensional bulk and a three-dimensional film? The attraction in terms of exact solution is that the bulk is in principle described exactly by mean field theory, but the behavior of the film, unfortunately, is non-classical. Okay, and so the question is what you really do is want to focus on the film, because that's where you have to do the calculation. And I want to point out that the other complication is you could think about looking at a two-dimensional Ising film, that just means simulate a two-dimensional Ising model. But it turns out that the if you look at the what you start with in the film, is it's not a two-dimensional leasing model. It is actually an effective Hamiltonian, because if the bulk is treated properly and you're close to the critical point of the bulk, the correct behavior is in principle in terms of a Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson, a field theoretical Hamiltonian with a fourth order coupling constant that is quite small. And that should be what you start with in the film. And so the question is, how do you evaluate the partition function, as I say, and especially the Casimir force, on this non-classical film? And I just want to kind of show you what we've been doing up to now, which is, I think, promising, but still not final. So the idea is actually first, because the kind of the numerical methods available to us, I don't do seventh order loop expansions, are numerical. And what we're going to do is try some kind of numerical evaluation of the of basically the Casimir force on a film. And so what we're starting with is, we're actually going to put the film on a lattice. So what we're going to start with is a Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson effective Hamiltonian. And then so the partition function is just going to be an integration over the spins, the variables of this effective Hamiltonian. And what we're kind of going to use is the fact that you can actually write this partition function in terms of a product of transfer matrices. That is, you associate terms like this with sites, and then this is actually associated with neighboring sites. And the way you do it is you write for a pair of sites, you kind of pull the local parts, you pull an appropriate part of the local part, portion of the local parts, into this transfer matrix, and then you put this coupling term here. So that the transfer matrix, which looks like this, can then be diagonalized in the same way as you diagonalize the transfer matrix for a one-dimensional Ising model. And so this is what the transfer matrix is going to look like for a pair of sites. That is an eigenvalue times, with an eigenfunction expansion. And in that case, the lattice, which we're just going to use a cubic lattice, is going to look like this. There are transfer matrices on the bonds, basically. But what we're going to do is we're going to put the eigenvalues on the bonds and then the associated eigenfunctions on the sites. So this is what these eigenfunctions look like. And just to kind of specialize, if I identify the bond with just a number, then if you look at this site, which is surrounded in two dimensions by bonds with numbers 3, 7, 10, and 2, this is what that vertex carries. This is the factor that the vertex carries. It's the integrated over the spin variable on that site of this product of four eigenfunctions. Now, I should make a point here, and that is, as in the case of the one-dimensional Ising model, these eigenfunctions are going to be either even or odd in the spin variable S. So in order for this to be non-zero, you have to have an even number of what I'll call odd parity eigenfunctions. Now, again, that recasts the problem, but it doesn't necessarily simplify it. The simplification is to truncate the eigenvalue expansion so that if you keep the two largest, for instance, the two largest eigenvalues of the transfer matrix, then there are two kinds of bond that I'm calling black and red. And there are actually d minus one types of vertex. So in two dimensions, these are the three kinds of vertex you can have. And the point is, if C1 is even parity, C2 is odd parity, then you can have this to the fourth, that to the fourth, or this squared times that squared. But you can't have this raised to either the first or the third power. So now you see that there are these three vertices. And then, that's what this is all about. Now, one way to look at it in two dimensions actually is using a version of the density matrix renormalization group of Steve White. Actually, it's called the transfer matrix renormalization group in statistical mechanics. And that's something that actually I did with a graduate student a while back. But I want to go to three dimensions, and that's something we can't do. And so the other way to look at it is using Monte Carlo. But the Monte Carlo method, because basically the fundamental variables are these little dumbbell-like things, doesn't involve kind of putting a spin variable on the site, but actually involves playing with these effective bond variables. And what you do is you basically bond flip. So this is what we do. And we do it on a plaquette. And by doing it that way, we ensure that we don't change the number, we keep an even number of odd parity eigenstates on a given lattice site. Because we're at any given lattice site, we're changing exactly two from even to odd, or from a combination of odd and even, you know, to the same combination. That shouldn't be, this is wrong. These are gone from black to red and red to black. That was a simple error in how I colored it. And so let me tell you how this is done. It's done in the simplest, least efficient Monte Carlo method. And that is you basically scan through the lattice, plaquette by plaquette. And it's a version of the Metropolis algorithm. For each plaquette, you decide with a probability of a half whether you're going to flip it or not. And if you flip it, then you evaluate the partition function before you flipped it and after you flipped it. And if the partition function after you flipped it is bigger, you keep it. And if it's smaller, then you keep it with a probability equal to the ratio of the new partition function to the old partition function. And that's basically maps onto the spin, kind of the spin Metropolis algorithm.
You don't mean global partition functions. You mean global,
well, I mean, yeah, but it, that changed. But in fact, the global partition function is basically just a product of local. Yeah, so, right, the rest of the spins are irrelevant to the comparison. The rest of the lattices are irrelevant to the comparison. And then, of course, after what I do is after each pass, I then evaluate the partition function. And this is kind of just a, you know, kind of a set of snapshots of the process. All the bonds are black means it's basically everything is, you've kept the leading order, only the leading order term in the expansion. This is the first step, and notice that two plaquettes have been flipped, and that there are just these little circles say that these are different kinds of vertices. Here's another one. Notice that this goes to here. This is a lattice with periodic boundary conditions. And then this is a little bit further along. And again, you can see by periodic boundary conditions, you have to pull things over to kind of complete this feature. But now there, you can see all three types. There's this vertex, which is two red lines and two black lines, and this one, which is three red lines. From that, you can calculate thermodynamic functions. And I'm focusing on the entropy because, as I said before, and entropy is going to kind of show up in the, we hope, in the Casimir force. And there are a variety of ways of describing entropy. One is in terms of the average of the square of a local spin variable. The other is in terms of the average of product of two neighboring spin variables. And these are just calculated. This is on a 4x4 lattice. And you can see that these curves track each other and seem to share features. And what I'm assuming is a slope that would be locally infinite if we had a sufficiently large system and did a sufficiently good job of Monte Carlo. Just as a side point, keeping two is the simplest possible version. You can also keep four. And in the case of a two-dimensional system, it turns out there are four kinds of bond, but 17 kinds of vertex now because of the various combinations. And in this case, there's a plaquette move, what I would call, is you flip, you basically keep, here are their four eigenstates, first even, first odd, and second odd. You know, and the eigenvalues go like largest to next largest to third largest to fourth largest. And when you flip one, you flip the color and you decide at random whether you're going to keep this as the first or the second one. So, so here I flip from the first odd to the first even. Here I flip from the first even to the second odd. And so you go through the lattice. This is how you go through the lattice on this Monte Carlo method. There is a difficulty when you start keeping more eigenfunctions, and that is when the partition function sum actually contains both positive and negative terms. So if you do a plaquette flip, as in this case, you can actually go from a case in which there are 10 negative vertices, these just happen to have negative values in terms of the partition function to 11. So you get from a configuration with an even a positive contribution to the partition function sum to one with a negative contribution. And of course, that's a challenge to deal with in Monte Carlo. But you can actually overcome that by summing separately over configurations, positive and negative configurations. And in fact, this is what I've gotten. This is what you get for the entropy here. in the case of 4. And again, it looks like you can see something like this. It turns out there's more scatter in the data because you just need to take more samples. So in the interest of full disclosure, I should say that all of the Monte Carlo was written as in Mathematica code and run on a laptop. So these count as preliminary calculations. In a three-dimensional lattice, I'm just keeping the two largest. There are 2 bonds and 4 vertices. If I had kept the 4 largest eigenvalue, there would be 4 bonds and 44 vertices, which would require 44 separate calculations for before any Monte Carlo run. Here's a particular configuration. The vertex is just indicated by spheres of different sizes. And here's the entropy function that we got from this. So let me just tell you now, given this background, how you calculate the Casimir force. So what we do to calculate the Casimir force is first, we say, write the order parameter of the film in terms of a mean field profile times an amplitude that varies within the film, the d-dimensional region occupied, d-1 dimensional region occupied by the film. We formulate the change in the effective Hamiltonian of the film induced by a change in the thickness of the film. This will be basically through its influence on the profile. And that gives rise to a quantity. If you take a derivative, that can be determined by Monte Carlo calculation. When you're done, when you finish calculating, you subtract the result for that quantity from the mean field free energy per unit volume of the bulk system. These are just equations that tell you how to kind of write down what we did. Here's the order parameter written in terms of an amplitude, depending on the 3 variables, x, y, z, that should be y, z, sorry, and w times a profile that goes like p of x. Here's how the Hamiltonian breaks down. If you then integrate over the thickness of the film to make it a full 3-dimensional Hamiltonian in terms of these integration variables, this is what it looks like. It's a slightly more complicated, not too much more complicated version of Ginzburg-Landau-Wilson. The profiles that we use are motivated by mean field theory. At a given reduced temperature, if the film is thinner than the kind of the critical thickness, the thickness at which you can get ordering, and that would be, for instance, all positive reduced temperatures, then the profile is a half a sine wave. If as the film gets thick enough to basically accommodate ordering in the mean field approximation, then the profile we use becomes this kind of elliptical function, the SN function. If we take the derivative of the effect of Hamiltonian with respect to film thickness, we get something that looks like this. It's got terms that go like the amplitude squared, the derivative of the amplitude squared, and the amplitude to the 4th power. And then what we do is we basically calculate the Casimir force by doing a Monte Carlo and calculating this average and then correcting for the bulk free energy. And the end result is of the preliminary calculation is something that looks like this. What I put here, this dotted line, is where mean field theory would tell you that you would get the minimum of the Casimir force for a film. For this film. So in fact, the Monte Carlo gives you a minimum below it. This feature, which looks like a very sharp, like almost a slope discontinuity, seems to be reflected in the Monte Carlo data. So that may actually recommend the entropic singularity, although I can't say for sure because we really haven't done the definitive calculation we need to do. What? It's the film is periodic. Right. The film itself is periodic because of course, we're stuck with a finite system. And the only way we can hope for some kind of convergence to bulk is to make it periodic. The boundary conditions perpendicular to the film are Dirichlet. And that's why we have those profile functions multiplying it. So the next stage of the calculation is first to write code in C and get it running on a fast computer so that we actually have something we can trust. Next to actually, as an analytic step, to go beyond this kind of quasi-mean field theory and do some good fluctuation calculations. One and two loop calculations, which are not incorporated in this. And I can explain why if we need to talk about it more. And then put them all together to get something that I think looks realistic and that kind of tells us what happens, especially as the film gets thicker and the effective renormalized coupling constant gets smaller and smaller. And it would be something like what was done by Masiolek et al. In the case of tricritical point. but we hope with looking at the film with in a kind of a more exact way. And thank you. If you look at it much more closely, it's not. It looks like it's not a slope discontinuity. It just shows up at this order of this degree of resolution. I don't think that it is.
And if you're seeing it through two-dimensionalizing transition, it should be an infinite.
Yeah, you know what I was. What I would have looked for is something here where this went like that. I would have. What I was hoping to see is something like this where it goes like that. I mean, I don't know whether that's somehow hidden in here, though. I mean, the fact is, if you have the problem is, which is another issue, is if a fourth order coupling constant is very small in the film, I think that actually shrinks the critical region, and so it may be harder to see. That's what I would have thought. But again, the data isn't good enough to say. Yeah.
Can you remark a bit more about, you said there is some kind of a debate between you and, I guess there was a group who's doing numerics, maybe Gambassi and Dahl.
Yeah, Dio,
yeah. And as far as I remember, they seem not to take the bulk into account.
I think. Let me just my. I'll tell you what my feeling in it. It was a non-debate. I think mathematically, what we did, each did was identical. You calculated change in the free energy with respect to film thickness, and then you basically subtract the bulk free energy, from that. And so the only argument was, maybe an explanation for why you do that, and we argued that the reason you do that physically is that the film is in equilibrium with a reservoir. Mm-hmm. So when the film gets thicker, the reservoir gets thinner, so that means you have to take a difference between free energies. I think that we may state it in possibly the clearest manner. So I think it was interpreted by some people as saying that we were invoking an extra mechanism. But in fact, mathematically, what we did was totally identical. There is effectively no disagreement between us. Was that Hooft?
Yeah.
At Hooft? Gerard at Hooft? Huh? No, not. Oh, Hooft. Hooft, yeah. It was Hooft. And in fact, I don't think that there was correspondence between us, direct correspondence. And I think that, I'm hoping that we now agree that what we were both doing is identical and that there is no true argument. Yeah. Okay, that would be interesting. But, the three...
We're working more in a film genre.
Yeah.
Because we have more.
Yeah, well, actually, remember, we're in one higher dimension. I believe we're in one higher dimension. So our film is three-dimensional, and our bulk is four-dimensional. Mm-hmm. It was an attempt essentially to try to go to a place where we had some kind of exact result mm-hmm. for the bulk. So we were trying to take what you did in three dimensions at the tri-critical point and pull it through it in four dimensions at the critical point. But of course, it would be very interested in seeing, comparing.
Among the model, photon can do exact calculation. There is, for instance, the free Bose gas.
Okay. Yes, on Bose condensation? I'll tell you what, in effect, we believe it has been done through the spherical model, which is kind of a mathematical twin, at least at the transition to the Bose gas. What the calculation was done for periodic boundary conditions, and in fact, that's one of the things that I showed you early on. We've attempted, among us, to do it with the Dirichlet boundary conditions, and got results that I don't understand. and I don't, and actually those results, but similar results have been published by Dome, Volker Dome. I don't know if anybody understands those results. It's, you basically get a Casimir force that diverges. I mean, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and it's not clear what's going on.
Did you try Neumann conditions?
No, we didn't. No, I mean, it would be an interesting thing to do. In the field theory, I always think of Neumann as being like periodic, but but you're requiring the slope to be zero, right? No, we didn't.
Doesn't force use the other parameter to bend that you wonder if
the derivative has to be flat. No, it would probably be an interesting calculation. We haven't done that. And we haven't done anti-periodic, which I think is also an extremely interesting, I think is a very interesting case. Yeah. Very likely, yeah. I mean, maybe with some differences, because plus minus, actually you're forcing the order parameter to take on a certain value, and periodic and anti-periodic. Yeah, the principle that the interface could wander out of the boundary at one end and into the into the system at the other. What?
Yeah. Probably it was
It could be, but well, I don't know if I don't know if it would wind, but it could actually do a good deal of wandering, right? I mean, it could wander. It could maybe wander around several times, you know, especially in an infinite system before coming back.
One D quantum systems, which for example is putting on liquids, where they can be mapped to 2D classical system layer. And of course the Laplace transition, so that would be a quantum phase transition, and there you could probably also look exactly at this effects by this effective description in terms of the 2D classical cost of the model.
Yeah.
Not
to my knowledge. I don't know. I mean, I guess what the answer is that there are a large number of systems that could be looked at. Yeah.
Can I ask you a question about the physical content of using Ising models to represent these forces in real systems? The thing that I seem to remember about the Ising model is that there's no internal dynamics, there are no spin waves. Two spins constrained along the z-axis don't actually torque on each other.
Yeah.
Because these systems do exhibit correlation, so you get an energy which depends on the thickness and that's
yeah.
What we're talking about. But in terms of a strict analogy with springy motions, such as spin waves in the Heisenberg model, which would be the analogs of the electromagnetic motors in the original Casimir effect. So what I'm trying to say is I think these systems, the Ising systems, are a little different in this respect. I mean, I certainly exhibit the effect that you found, but the calling it a Casimir is maybe
there are fluctuations, though. There are fluctuations.
It's a bit of a different nature.
Yeah,
yes,
it's caused by critical fluctuations.
Of course, yeah, but nevertheless, there's an effect on the thickness of energy as a function.
No, I mean, right, and in fact, the dynamics are. You know, you kind of, when you're doing these calculations, you're blind to the dynamics of the system.
So this doesn't put it in somebody using Ising and doesn't put it in some kind of different class or different.
It was Merrill just told me about something I knew I should have known a lot about, and there's even experiments involving demixing the critical point.
Yeah, so
and that's basically.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, and that.
I'm interested in this question because in a quite different context, I've been looking at the Van der Waals and Casimir dispersion forces between graphene sheets.
Yeah.
And these are interesting because they have, of course, electrons can slide up and down. There's a zero electronic gap. But these systems have, in fact, no plasma. They have no springy motions of the electronic system. And so in some ways, they're analogous to an Ising model where there are correlations but no normal modes with real frequencies.
motion.
Really? There's no.
There's still nevertheless a van der Waals force, and it goes by a quite unconventional power law as a function of distance. So that's why I'm interested in this question. I see here that I thought I was being sort of out on a limb by even calling this van der Waals, but I see that, or Casimir, but I see that the, your field is rich with examples where this kind of thing is called Casimir systems with no springy modes internally, but nevertheless which have some distance-dependent correlation energy.
Yeah, I think here, I think
it's a critical point in a long-range correlation, which parallels what you hear for the electromagnetic field, and it's not even power laws. But the dynamics is totally irrelevant for this kind of question.
Yeah, so it's just a question of the long-range correlation.
Yeah, I mean, basically what you want is you want a kind of an extended fluctuation that costs arbitrarily small energy to excite. And in critical at the critical point, it's requires an arbitrarily small amount of free energy to excite this.
That's exactly
what one sees. Yeah. But it's actually, but remember, the Ising model, there is no continuous symmetry to break. And that's why there's in principle full recovery. Because at low temperatures, again, things get frozen in. And
so
just
if you were to try to solve, for example, Heisenberg models of the same systems, if that were possible, you wouldn't expect a significantly different behavior?
Mm-hmm. Or it would be.
Yeah.
Of course.
I mean, it's significantly different in what, I guess, question in what way. For instance, it wouldn't fully recover.
I mean, you get things which restrict the analogies to the original acid and because you have explicit waves and zero-point motions, you can talk about.
That's right. At low temperature, there would be Goldstone bosons would persist, which means you would have. Exactly. Well.
Yeah.
Just